Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. When was the last time you listened to a podcast that whispered a secret into your ear? Or tapped deep into the memories of your first love? The Heart is that podcast. For years, producers of The Heart have woven together sound-rich and sensitive retellings of some of the most intimate stories that happen to us in life, yet rarely are represented on the radio. Like listening to your inner dialogue when you're deciding to kiss someone for the first time, or learning the tiny yet crushing realities of long-distance love, and so many other experiences of gender, of sexuality, and of identity. All with incredibly inventive sound design. And since joining the independent podcast network Radiotopia last year, The Heart is becoming stronger than ever, regularly releasing both short and long-form episodes. In their latest short, they share the story of, well, actually, I don't want to give it away. Cue the heartbeat.
Short and Sweet by The Heart. A little history. Copenhagen, sometime in the early 20th century. The studio of married painters, Einar and Gerda Wegener.
I recollect one evening in the first years of our marriage. We were living in a studio which commanded a wide view over Copenhagen. Gerda was reading me a primitive fable out of antiquity. It ran something like this. Hermes, the darling of the gods, had a son, and Aphrodite, the divine beauty, a daughter. One day, they confronted each other in the woods of the gods. The girl was immediately enamored of the boy, but the boy fled from her. In despair, the divine maiden turned to Zeus and bewailed to him her love torment. I love him, father, but he has fled from me. Oh, father, grant that I become one with him. And Zeus raised his arm. And the next moment, the shy son of Hermes stood before the Olympian, and Aphrodite's daughter shouted with glee. And again, Zeus raised his arm. Both melted into each other. When Hermes and Aphrodite sought after their children, they found a blissfully smiling divine child. It is my son, cried Hermes. No, it is my daughter, cried Aphrodite. They were both right. About this time, Gerda painted the portrait of the then popular actress in Copenhagen, Anna Larsen. One day, Anna was unable to attend the appointed sitting. On the telephone, she asked Gerda, who was somewhat vexed, Cannot Einar pose as a model for the lower part of the picture?
His legs and feet are as pretty as mine.
Einar, would you pose in the place of Anna?
At first, I declined rather shortly.
No.
Gerda chafed
Please?
Me.
No, I feel...
Abused me.
Shy.
Implored
yes.
me.
No.
Petted
yes.
me.
Yes.
I can't, no.
Just this once.
And a few minutes later, I was standing in the studio in costume and high-heeled shoes. And to make the disguise complete, Gerda fetched out a carnival wig from the depths of a trunk. A fair, very curly wig. And drew it over my head. And then she attacked me with rouge and powder, while I subjected to everything. When all was ready, we could scarcely believe our eyes. I turned around and stared at myself in a mirror again and again, trying to recognize myself. Was it really possible that I could be so good-looking? And I cannot deny, strange though it may sound, that I enjoyed myself in this disguise. I liked the feel of soft women's clothing. I felt at home from the first moment.
Hello? I have time.
A moment later, Anna Larsen rustled into the studio. She had managed to find time. She said, You know, Einar.
You were certainly a girl in a former existence. Or else nature has made a mistake with you.
I made a movement to retire, but Anna Larson held me back. No, she said.
I simply could not endure to meet Einar again today. We won't even speak of him. Listen, and now I will christen you, my girlie. You shall receive a particularly lovely, musical name.
What do you say to Lily?
Henceforth, I will call you Lily. We must celebrate this. What do you say, Gerda?
And Gerda merely nodded, looking now at Anna, now at the child about to be christened. And then the three of us kept up rejoicings into the night. Lily's christening night.
One of the earliest and most compelling narratives of a transgender life is Lily Elba's book, Man into Woman. Lily Elba and her wife, Gerda Wegener, were painters who married in 1904. Gerda's favorite model was Lily, and the greatest accounts of Lily's life, aside from her book, are Gerda's paintings. When Lily transitioned, she stopped painting. She said,
I do not want to be an artist, but a woman. Hence, I shall shut out all artistic creation out of my life, because I cannot continue the work of the virile artist who was Einar.
On the other hand, Gerda's work flourished. Her depictions of women in erotic situations, sometimes with each other, sometimes with mythical creatures, were particularly popular. She illustrated for Vogue, she published an art book about Casanova's sexual exploits. Unfortunately, the notoriety of the couple led to Lily's outing, and their marriage was annulled by the King of Denmark. Their travels took them from Copenhagen to Paris, and then Berlin and Dresden, where Lily had her gender confirmation surgeries. She was among the first to do so, and the surgeries were not as we know them today. Lily's third surgery, meant to implant a uterus, eventually killed her. Gerda never recovered from Lily's death, and she died alone in a small apartment in Copenhagen 9 years later. Lily's hope was that her book, compiled by an editor after her death, fall into the hands of people like her. She wanted her words to help generations of trans people know that they weren't alone. Man into Woman is now out of print, but we at The Heart managed to get our hands on a copy. A movie about Lily is in development, so her story may reach more people than she ever imagined.
This piece was brought to you by the amazing Samara Brieger. She's one of the Heart Stars. The other Heart Stars are Mitra Kaboli, Jen Ng, Megan Dietrich, Shira Bannerman, editorial advising from Sharon Mashihi. Thank you in particular on this episode to Callie Rasmussen, who is the voice of Lily Elba. Callie has her own radio show, which you should totally check out. It's called Not All Women. And thank you to Radiotopia, of which we are a proud member.
Radiotopia. From PRX.
If you need more of The Heart in your life, subscribe to the podcast now on iTunes. Or find out more about the show at theheartradio.org. Transformation is a big theme for the podcast Arrivals. Each episode focuses on one story of change and migration. And so far, they've covered surviving an airplane crash, arriving at boarding school, and dressing up as a superhero to bike across America. And that's just in the show's first season. Whenever I listen to Arrivals, I feel like I'm sitting inside a confessional. A fly on the wall, watching one person share a very personal story in full detail and without fear. Recently, Arrivals put the spotlight on a journey that took place right here in our Bay Area.
Way before I had ever met Lee, it was just something I knew about myself, or I thought I did, was that I didn't have the foresight or the skills or that kind of overarching knowledge that you need to have to be a good parent. And I thought, best not try.
I'm Jonathan Hirsch, and you're listening to Arrivals. Stories of migration, transformation, and change through the eyes of extraordinary men and women. The program that explores what we do when what we've done is a thing of the past. And this is the story of Julie Sparenberg.
I'm Julie Sparenberg, and I live in Vallejo, California. My partner, Lee, we moved together from Palo Alto. We just had enjoyed always coming up to visit San Francisco, and one day it dawned on us that we should move here, and so we moved and found a great flat right in the Inner Sunset. And we were together for almost 10 years. We were, I don't want to say friends with benefits, because I do think that there was a lot of love there. I think that we were definitely just two very different people coexisting in a space we both really liked a lot. And so we had a really great apartment, and we had two very separate lives, and we cared about each other, but we had a lot of things we didn't share. Came home, and Lee had suffered a stroke while I was out. I can't even put into words that feeling of coming home and seeing somebody that you love on the floor close to death. Brains are mysterious organs. They heal on their own time frame, and we don't know why or how sometimes. But, you know, he ended up having to move back home and living with his parents. Just there was too much care that I couldn't provide and that I couldn't pay for either. You know, you know, when something like that happens to you, you just have to deal with things as they come up. Luckily, I had a job at a nonprofit, and my boss was extremely understanding when I just couldn't come in. I had to be at the hospital for something. And so my work life dwindled down to almost nothing. And we had to move out. And so I spent my last weeks in San Francisco packing up everything and moving them into storage for Lee to deal with at some point. When you go and spend a lot of time in the hospital, I mean like every day for weeks and then months, you get a really clear view of how quickly things can change for somebody. When you're watching somebody you love in a hospital bed in pain and suffering, it's like it's happening to you. And then you get to that point where you realize, that could be me. I could be the person, that could be me next time. What I called home was gone. My best friend in the world was in many ways gone. And I couldn't enjoy my city. So I had to figure out how to navigate this new life that I didn't want. It took a while, but part of me felt after a while like you need to get out, you need to spend time with people, you need to start doing things that don't involve going to a hospital every day or feeling sad, which is hard when you felt sad for a long time.
Two doves came in the snow and rain, gray and white in the middle of the night, and they watched me. Yes, they watched.
And I ended up meeting somebody that I never expected to meet. When somebody thought they had met their, quote, soulmate, that they were somewhat delusional and had watched too many movies or something like that, that those things didn't really happen. And then when it happened to me, I felt really stupid and funny. You know, I thought that was kind of great, actually.
Do you pray like me? in the middle of the night.
When I met Aaron, actually we had a phone date, I guess if you can call it that. And I was sick. Like I had a sore throat and I was losing my voice. And we couldn't stop talking on the phone. And it was really funny. We both don't now really remember what our conversation was, but he kept losing cell phone reception and had to keep calling me back. And I kept saying, I'm not going to be able to talk much longer. My voice won't last. And we both kept saying we should hang up or our phones are dying. And we pretty much talked until I had no voice left and we had no phone batteries. And then when we decided to meet, it felt like everything had already happened. Like it was a formality of us meeting and realizing that that person on the phone was just as incredible in real life. Aaron has two daughters, Nadia and Mila. And Nadia, we met at the children's playground. And we walked there. We met at the Conservatory of Flowers. We walked to the children's playground. And by the time we had gotten to the children's playground, Nadia grabbed one of my hands and looked at me straight in the eye and said, I knew I would love you. And I was so close to tears. It's just she was so matter of fact and sure of herself that I was like, it took my breath away. It still does to even think about that she knew right then. She said, I knew as soon as I saw you that I would love you.
Does the holy notion hear a cry? Do you tie your letters tight? What do you see when you close your eyes?
I couldn't believe I was having these thoughts. I thought, I'm going to ask Aaron to marry me. This is crazy. I'm going to ask him to marry me. And because we think the same, I didn't even get a chance to ask him. It was that same day that he asked me. We got married 5 weeks after we met, which I think for people I'm sure a majority of people who knew me thought I was crazy. I kind of did in a way. But then other people totally got it. I was like, you know what? This is here. And I think this is what's going to happen. And I don't believe it's a mistake. And if it is, then oh well. But again, I think the other more mortal lessons are hanging over my head. It's like, you know, sometimes you just have to go and take that leap. And this was one where I had complete trust that we were going to be a family. And so when we decided to get married, I'm sure the first time where I felt that with the girls was when we were getting married. And again, Nadia, in her infinite child wisdom, said that we were all getting married. It was their wedding day, too.
Do you cry? Do you pray like me? In the middle of the night.
Arrivals is produced, written, and recorded two stories above the snow-covered porches of the lovely East Williamsburg neighborhood of Brooklyn, New York, by me, Jonathan Hirsch. Special thanks to Julie, Aaron, Mila, and Nadia Sparenberg for sharing their story. To Ben Cruz for providing mixing, mastering, and sound design help with today's episode. And to my wife and other half, Valerie Hirsch.
Two dust came in the snow and rain, gray and white.
The song weaving its way in and out of today's episode is called Two Doves and was performed by the Tucson-based band Wolf Larson. More on their beautiful music can be found at wolflarsonmusic.com. If you like what you've heard today, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find a link to it right on the front of our website, along with our archives, written work, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook pages, all at arrvls.com. Additionally, I release a weekly microcast about arrivals, life in New York, and much more called En Route, which you can find there as well. And until we meet again, may you wind up where you need to be.
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. And lastly today, I want to leave you with one final and really fun story of shifting identity that was told live at Spark London. If you like the Moth Radio Hour, you are going to dig Spark London. Here's presenter Joe Coffey, recorded live in 2012.
Hiya. My story, basically, I'm a massive fan of Dallas. Not the place, the TV show, very much so. I've got 8 box sets, and I've watched some of them more than once. And at the moment, I'm just at the part where Bobby's dead, and I've completely replaced Miss Ellie with some random that I don't like. Not big on change, but I'm trying to deal with it as we go. So, firstly, why I like Dallas. There's a million reasons why I like Dallas, but the main reason is it's really arrogant. It's like the most arrogant TV show that you'll ever see. So on episode 1, when the budget's really low, Bobby and Pam go to a nightclub to go and find Lucy, who's like slagging it around on the dance floor. They go down and sort it all out and bring her back. And before they go, the episode ends on them giving it a bit of 70s jiving on the dance floor, and they're really going for it. And then you hear, as the music gets louder, what they're dancing to is da 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 da. They're like dancing to their own theme tune, which is like so arrogant but wonderful at the same time. So when I got given the opportunity to meet J.R. Ewing in the person, I was willing to lie, steal, and beg to meet that man and shake him by the hand and tell him what a difference he's made to my life in general. So at the time, I was working at the BBC as a researcher on a very important entertainment celebrity programme. And on JR Day in particular, I'd been pulled into a meeting with my executive producer, and he'd said, today we want you to go and find a monkey. I was like, all right. He was like, not any monkey, we want it to have really big hands. So it can pull off little triangles of celebrities' faces from a washing line. I was like, okay, fine. So off I went out into the back to go and find this monkey. As soon as I sat down, I get a call from my friend, flatmate, and fellow Dallas fan. She's also a music plugger and she's down at the BBC. Phones me and says, you never guess what? Wogan, Now and Then, has been filmed today in Studio One. They've got Pam, Bobby, and JR. I've managed to get us a couple of tickets. Do you want to go? I was like, yeah, monkey schmonkey, get out of there, like, whatever. So go down and see the show, and it was brilliant. We had such a good time. It was wonderful. There was like loads of gay men in Stetsons, and everyone was just having like such a laugh. And then it came on, it turns out like Bobby is like the real Joker of Dallas. And he put like a couple of bananas in J.R. Ewing's bed when he was about to have a love scene with Sue Ellen. And it was just, everyone laughed. It was hysterical. As we came out, it wasn't enough. It really wasn't. And like, I was starting to like saying to people, we want to go meet them. That was a good fix, but I want to meet him. So I'm getting all this attention by this point because I'm getting about 20 calls through on my mobile phone about this stupid monkey. And I'm having to like, say things like, well, how big are its hands exactly? No, I'm sorry, that's too small. I'm going to have to call you back. No, sorry, that's too expensive. And it was getting ridiculous. But it attracted the attention of the editor of the Dallas website. It was a very camp gentleman. And my friend brought over this really important woman in entertainment, in television. And she was really important, but what was fabulous about her is she had the most amazing high-pitched voice that was like a bell. So when she spoke, you'd be like, oh, God, I'm shattered. Oh, God, just shut up. Oh, no, she was really authoritarian. So between us, we decided to concoct this plan of to get in the dressing room. And then we just batted around a few excuses. The first thing that we came up with was to go and get a load of headphones from upstairs, just put them on and pretend we work for the show and just stroll in the dressing room like really casually. then we realised that that was blown because I stick out like a sore thumb and I'm having about 20 calls about a monkey that I'm having to deal with every 5 seconds. So what we decided on in the end was for me and Claire to pretend we were competition winners for the Dallas website. An entertainment lady would take us all down there and introduce us all and say, I'm here from the Dallas website, we're here to meet J.R. Ewing. So we all go stomping down to the dressing room. And there's this researcher on the door, and she's like 19. She's got the typical researcher's scarf on, the UGG boots, you know, the headphones. And even I thought in my head, really innocently, we're so going to break her. No problem at all. I say, but oh no. We get to the first thing the very important entertainment lady does is stick her hand across the door and sort of bend half of her body inside the thing and go, it's James in there, it's James in there. And of course, researcher turned around and went, there is no James that works on this show. If you've got any problems, take it up with the executive producer. It's blown completely. So then she comes out with a double whammy. She's like, well, I'm here with all the competition winners from the Dallas website. We're here to have their picture taken with J.R. Ewing. So can you let us in, please? Again, I don't have any competition winners on my list. If you've got any problems, can you sort it out with the executive producer? By this point, like, entertainment woman is just bubbling. You can tell. She's like layers and layers and layers of frustration upon frustration until she absolutely explodes and shouts at her, we're coming in! Like, it just pushes her out of the way, and we finally get into this room. Finally. And it's hideous. It's absolutely hideous. She's wall-to-wall TV people everywhere, all getting smashed with champagne. Like Wogan's in the corner, he's talking about Bruce Willis, about the time that he came on the show and they all had such a laugh. And everyone's muffling and getting in each other's way. And I'm like, I don't think I can stand this. I can't even see JR, let alone anyone really. But in the corner, past all the belts and people's skirts and rubits, I saw a sofa, like in the distance. And I thought, this is ridiculous. There's a sofa, there's like a haven to this dressing room. So I'm sort of pushing my way through. I don't give at any point any thought to why in this massively crowded dressing room no one sat on this sofa until I sit down and I realise there's a massive Stetson next to me. And I'm like, oh no, this is J.R. Ewing's chair. Oh no, I better get up. But just as I do, J.R. Ewing comes over and puts his hand on the Stetson and catches my eye. I light up. He lights up in like all those times at the end of Dallas where he gives you a real baddies look, like a big twinkle in the eye. And he says to me, yeah, little lady, have one of these. It's a $100 bill with a picture of his face on. The best day of my life. Thank you.
That was Jo Coffey sharing her story live at Spark London, produced by Matt Hill. You can hear more stories and find out about their next live night at sparklondon.com. You can also subscribe to their podcast right now on iTunes.
My daddy thinks I'm gone for good, but mama, she knows better. In Dallas, I'll be coming home to you.
That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Just look at the homepage for the little blue letters that spell out The Spot. And then click them. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.